Hello, this is Mark Shenton. Welcome you to Theatre Voice and a long overdue critical roundup of the latest openings in the West End and beyond, sponsored by Palgrave Macmillan. We're intending to relaunch The Strand in the autumn in a new format, but meanwhile we reunite our regular team once more today as I'm joined by David Benedict, Matt Wolfe, Kate Bassett and our editor Dominic Cavendish. We'll be looking at a series of revivals and new plays in two separate parts. In the first recording, we turn to a series of revivals, including two first seen in the 1980s. Karen McIntosh's blockbuster musical Miss Saigon, originally premiered in 1989 at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane, and now back in a revamped production at the Prince Edward, and Brian Friel's 1987 adaptation of Turgenev's 1862 novel Fathers and Sons, to be seen in a new production of the Donmar Warehouse. We also have David Hare's 1995 play Skylight at Wyndham's, and a new production of Arthur Miller's 1954 classic The Crucible at the Old Vic. Miss Saigon was the last of the original mega musicals created in the West End when it originally premiered at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane. Its return to town now, 15 years on from when that original production closed, isn't just a chance to present a historical curiosity, but an opportunity for producer Cameron McIntosh to both reinvent it for a new generation and reinvest it with an even bigger sense of scale and spectacle. David, do you reckon he succeeded?
I don't really. I mean, it's you know, it to a degree it works. You know, it's a big show. I'm one of those rare people that prefers Miss Saigon to the blockbuster Les Mis from the same team. But I just feel that this is so busy doing display and so busy busting a gut and showing you how big a gut it's busting, yeah, that it never allows the audience in. The audience sort of sits there and applauds the spectacle, but I never felt drawn in.
Of course, those of us who saw the original Nick Heitner production, it was sort of semi-operatic, wasn't it? It was a lot of it was to do with the Madame Butterfly source it came from. And this production is much more musical theatre, almost X Factor.
Yes, that's an interesting way to put it. I mean, the thing about the original, which I remember very well, was that it was a superb sort of convergence directorially of the intimate and the epic. It was on this big stage. There were sort of big, wow production numbers, principally The American Dream, which is the climax of the second act, which Jonathan Pryce sort of danced and sleazed his way to an Olivier and a Tony. But then there'd be these kind of quiet, rather extraordinarily still moments, which were all the more powerful for being backed up by this huge stage. This one is much more relentless. It's much more of a piece, and that piece is less interesting. I suppose what is interesting about this production is having an Asian actor play the part of the engineer. And I did think Jean-Jean Briones, who is in every way the opposite of Jonathan Pryce, for one thing, he's not British or European, he's Filipino, and he's physically tiny. He's a little sort of wisp of a man with a great stage presence. And it was wonderful to see him play a part that he has played before. There's a young teenager from the States, from North Carolina, Evan of Lazada, playing Kim. Untrained, and in a way that sort of helps because she seems very green, as does the character in the context that Kim, Miss Saigon, finds herself in. So there are pluses and balances. Do I feel like I need to see the show again ever in my life? Probably not.
It's interesting you mentioned the controversy over Jonathan Pryce, because it was recently at the National we had a play about that very thing that had transferred from The Park, the David Henry Hwang play,
Yellow Face,
mm-hmm. Sure. Based on the controversy that also arose around the Face Value, his previous play. Dominic, are you a virgin to Miss Saigon, or was this a new experience?
Yes, no, very much a virgin, and I was of a sort of age of instant sneering contempt when Saigon was first launched upon the world. And I remember there was just that wave, wasn't there, of British musicals that all seemed to have some massively symbolic bit of scenery working on their behalf. And I think Miss Saigon, with its famous helicopter scene, or kind of famous almost before the show opened, sort of put me off it in a way that I've now come to regret, having seen the show for the first time. And also having, and I suppose negotiating it's already a cumulative success. So it's open to a huge advance. There are tourists sort of decking out the stalls. There's people behind me babbling in different tongues and very excited to be there. So it's an event now. But I think, you know, you misunderstand the show if you only home in on its spectacle and the famous helicopter scene. There's no disputing the fact that it is a kind of eye-catching bit of, you know, spectacular. But I think that there's something very honest about this musical, which I didn't expect to find. It's got glitz, of course, it's got a kind of cynicism, it's got razzmatazz somehow skewed from Broadway over to the other side of the world. But the, you know, essential part of it, this story of damage wrecked by war, the sense of what happens to you if you are choosing between two worlds, and your powerlessness in the face of military occupation. I think these things come across really, really powerfully in the music. The whole thing orchestrates itself fantastically around these kind of endlessly circling dilemmas and crises, so that you're watching a kind, you're sort of drawn into a dream world, a nightmare world of irreconcilable opposites.
Indeed, you just mentioned the orchestration. I mean, William Bron's orchestration is actually one of the key factors of the score's success. Makes it sound much better than it actually is, I think.
I would slightly question that. Not the orchestrations. I think the orchestrations are very, very strong. I do think this is a successful score of its type. It's not particularly to my taste, but I think it achieves what it sets out to do, and the fact that it's not to my taste is relevant. It works as a piece of, or it should work as a piece of theatre. I think that the show's great selling point is also strangely a difficulty. The central performance by Ava Noble-Tsarda is fantastic. As Matt says, she's 18 years old. She's got this incredibly powerful voice, and she's got stillness. And everything around her is incredibly focused and allows the script and the ideas of the script that Dominic was pointing out to rise up almost like kind of some strange perfume out of this show. And when she's working and you don't see her doing hard work, then everything seems to happen. But she's paired opposite Alistair Brammer, who's got a very, very good voice and is working so hard that it's sort of like watching a weightlifter. You just admire the effort involved. But I felt completely unengaged from his performance because he's going, look how much I'm working to prove everything in the show. And it just felt like too much.
It's quite a strenuous production, isn't it? It is working.
Yeah, I have to say that the funny thing is, oddly and perhaps paradoxically, I remember very vividly being completely unmoved at the press night of the first one, admiring the stagecraft, admiring much of the score, but just not being moved for whatever reason. And this one, I was moved, and I really think Ava Noble-Tsarda has a lot to do with that. Lea Salonga, who was already a professional when she was cast in the original production, albeit a teenager, had a kind of cool about her that was very distant, and it didn't draw me in as you weren't drawn in by Alistair Brammer. But Ava absolutely got me to the nub of it. So in a funny way, on an effective level, I was more touched by this one.
But I do think that there is a problem in that, you know, we're both agreeing that her performance is really central and really crucial and moving, but I didn't find the show was. And I think the problem is the direction and also the design. You know, the greatness of John Napier's original design wasn't just the helicopter. Of course, that's what everybody remembered because it was such a coup, but actually there was a kind of scale and grandeur, as Matt says, to the big moments. But it also had the simplicity. This is incredibly busy. It's got a very uncharacteristically busy lighting design by Bruno Poet, who is a tremendous lighting designer, but it feels like he's gone, oh, you want this and this and this and this, and states keep coming up and sets keep moving around, and you just go, calm down and be more expressive. It's the director is trying to prove something, and I wish he'd just allowed the show to work.
Don't you think it also looks a little cramped on the stage that it's inhabiting, whereas at Drury Lane it just sat beautifully?
But I do think that's about the design, not necessarily about the spaces. Yeah. It was about Napier having a much more uncluttered vision.
Right.
And of course, the sense of scale is that the Drury Lane seats over 2,000, for the Prince Edward only 1,600. So it's going to be to a different level anyway.
Yeah.
Dominic,
I think I'm absolutely siding or deferring to that sense that this production may actually be inferior to the original. But I would say that there is probably enough easy skepticism about the show anyway. That maybe one should take a look if one's wavering, because there has been a sort of sense that, oh, this is the show that pushes all these buttons, and you sit there and it's very polished and it's very slick, but actually in some form it's kind of heartless and even exploitative of a genuine war experience for some kind of entertainment gain. And I think actually it's more real than that. It's more honest than that,
with the exception of the Act Two opener.
The
Act Two opener, which apparently even Nick Heitner wanted to cut when it went to Broadway,
the single most emotionally repellent song from any musical I know, and not done any favors in this production because it's about 1,000 times over the top.
Accompanied, we should say, by a film of orphans in Saigon
and the victims of war. And
it's the worst kind of trading on something rather than writing something to be truly emotional. It rides on the back of it, but yeah, I think nonetheless it's worth seeing. It is something to see,
and the truth is that there's a whole generation who haven't seen it, and this will be an opportunity for them to do so.
It also might be worth pointing out, which is rather bizarre, that when the revival of Cats opens later this year, all of the defining 1980s mega musicals will once again be playing in London,
apart from Starlight Express.
I count the big four. Cats, Les Mis, Phantom, and Miss Saigon. And that's really strange. It's like we're going into a time warp.
We are, absolutely. Talking of time warp, the great Irish dramatist Brian Friel has long had a special affinity with the Russian masters Chekhov and Turgenev. And director Lindsay Turner has a particular passion for Friel, having previously directed a beautiful production of his first major success, Philadelphia, Here I Come, at the Domai in 2012. Now Turner and Friel are back at the Domai with Friel's 1987 adaptation of the 1862 novel Fathers and Sons, which was previously produced in London at the National Theatre. Kate, again, this is one people have seen before. Did you see that National Theatre production?
I didn't, actually. No, I didn't. So this is my first time.
Oh, you did, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
So
Had a very young Ralph Fiennes in it.
Do you remember it?
No.
Isn't that one of the interesting things about this?
I don't remember a single thing about it.
Is that we do see these plays, some of these shows, again and again, and we sometimes never remember them, unlike Miss Saigon, which we did. So, Kate, what were your impressions on seeing it for the first time?
That's actually rather interesting, because I do wonder if I will remember this in 20 years' time. I think it looks very beautiful. It's set on the just outside the building of a country, on a country estate. It's a sort of month in the country drama, in a way. And it's sort of ramshackle, slightly decaying weatherboards, and it's rather scenically ramshackle. And there's a sense that the skeleton of the wood is angling sharply into a corner, and what that creates is a kind of sense of a vortex, and what's happening is there's this sort of conservative old school gentry, essentially, and the son's come back from college and he's brought a friend who is a radical, kind of revolutionary. He wants a utilitarian future, so you see the Russian Revolution coming in a way. And you get the sense of this old school world being dragged into the future. I think what didn't quite grab me was I didn't... Seth Numbridge plays the firebrand. And I don't think I quite believed his politics. I didn't feel that it was fully ingrained in his character, this kind of Russian full-on intellectual idealism. But apart from that, I thought there were lots of beautiful performances, and I thought a lot of the women were very good. I thought Elaine Cassidy, as this young widow who's attracted to the firebrand, was very good. And there's this crotchety old princess played by Suzanne Engel. But somehow it hasn't quite stuck. I think it's most interesting as one in a kind of collage of Russian plays that we've seen. So Gorky's Enemies at the El Major a while back, and Philistines, Gorky also at the National Theatre. So you get this sort of myriad of plays about the coming, and Chekhov, of course, myriad of plays about the coming revolution that form a rather interesting overview. But I don't think this, though it's a nice adaptation, will stick with me hugely.
Of course, the actor you mentioned, Seth Numbridge, is an American actor who from Broadway, who recently in Sweet Bird of Youth at the Old Vic with Kim Cattrall. Matt, what did you make of this?
Well, I can sort of see why I don't remember the 1987 production very well, which is not, I'm not slighting it in any way, but there's something sort of strangely wispy and ephemeral about this play. I only saw it a couple of weeks ago. I don't remember much about this either. And it's not like a Chekhov play where every moment is emotionally anchored. It's that strange evening, and I think this is in Brian Friel's text more than anything else, that seems oddly too short. You're sort of getting to know the characters, and then they disappear. A couple of them die. Time passes. They're mourning people who you've never really met. A great friendship is supposedly there, but it's insufficiently dramatized given the weight it's then asked to bear. And it was over, and I just sort of thought, okay. It kind of falls into the category of, well, that was fine, and what's next?
It is beautiful while you're watching it.
It is beautiful. I mean, the odd thing is that actually it's both of the Lindsay Turner Friel Productions at the Donmar have used an identical stage footprint from the same designer. You get a big diagonal space being cut up by a wall that you can see through. But you know, both productions exactly the same, but different in tone, and it is lovely to look at. But I think that the real problem here is the fact that it is unlike the Chekhov plays that people are talking about, or the Gorky plays that people are talking about. It is an adaptation. I have no problem with adapting novels. Michael Billington in The Guardian is often inveighing against the idea of adapting novel. I don't see any problem if you can find a way of making them dramatic on a stage, and this doesn't. This takes novelistic incident, and I've not read the original, I've not read the novel, but you can see that it takes incidents which are plotted gently through the novel and tries to make them dramatic and actually fails so to do. There are several female characters that clearly resonate through the novel, but they're just not given enough stage time or enough stage plot in order to kind of anchor the feelings that the actors are trying to give it. It just seems to lack substance. That said, there are, as you say, there are delights along the way, and I would single out Anthony Carf, who I think is one of the most underrated actors in Britain. He plays this complete ditherer, and unlike most people who go, "Ooh, look, I'm playing a dithery character, I'll dither the whole time," he doesn't. He's got incredible dynamism, so he charges up every scene he's in because he's really trying to work out exactly what this character should be doing, and then he changes his mind because his character is a ditherer, and it makes it very dynamic to watch. But a lot of the time, a lot of the other characters are sort of in repose, and you go, "That's kind of lovely, but I don't care that much."
I think there's something interesting and problematic about the fact that I think the novel, in a way, is about how the things that you expect to happen in life and the big events that are meant to happen in life don't happen. So there's this kind of revolutionary guy, and he gets kind of sidelined by love. And the kind of the big events don't happen. And in a way, a novel allows that sense of drift more easily. So I was kind of intrigued to see a play that was trying to do that, and yet in a way it felt as if it was too compacted to really.
It may well just be the wrong novel to do.
I think too compacted is a good phrase, because presumably what the play is trying to do is show the limitations of the Seth Newmarch character's nihilism, and the way in which any ism that we subscribe to in life is then scuppered by life. And that's sort of an interesting thesis, but it's actually more interesting as a thesis than it is as a dramatic entity, to me anyway.
And talking of thesis, there's an awful lot of them in Skylight, the David Hare play. Have you read Freud, asks the 18-year-old Edward, within minutes of paying an unexpected call at the bleak, chilly North London flat of his father's former mistress? And a beat later, of course, you're being told what Freud says. "I read some recently. I told Dad everything had to come out, that you pay a price. For everything you've repressed, there's a price to be paid." Audiences are having to pay a very high price indeed themselves to hear this stuff expressed. Tickets, I noticed today, cost up to £127.25 for a play that runs 2 hours and only features three actors. But given that two of them are Bill Nighy and the up-and-coming star Carey Mulligan, joined by newcomer Matthew Beard, is it a price worth paying, do you think, Kate?
I enjoyed it. I think the strength of the play is that it's a kind of chamber piece. And I think, in a way, David Hare, when he does his... I like David Hare's verbatim docudramas, but I think sometimes when he takes his ideas and puts them in fiction, there is more kind of setting out of ideas in a way that feels unintegrated with the characters. In a way, I think, having a few characters, they're more lived in. And I think the play... Essentially, it's about a rich Thatcherite entrepreneur who's had a previous affair with someone who's very left-wing and has gone and taught in a kind of rundown comprehensive. And so there's a clash of cultures. And it's a rather obvious clash of cultures, you know, they're polar opposites in many ways. But I think what happens is that you still get a topicality about that. So essentially you get this real sense of a wealth gap. And I think that chimes with today, couple of decades on. I think what was interesting about the production is I found Carey Mulligan much more compelling. She has she's the young woman who doesn't really want to get back into the affair with this older guy. And she has a sort of still deceptively calm power. It's her flat and he's turned up. Bill Nighy, I found I find him incredibly mannered as an actor. He's a kind of mountain of mannerisms, a bit like Olivier was at one stage. And he does, I think, deliberately contrasting his physicality with hers. He sort of whirls around and spins on his toes and is endlessly restless, and sort of comes downstage quite a bit and does some rather set speeches downstage. And I struggled with that. But there's something about Bill Nighy that I think he pulls it off. I think he's a rather wonderful character actor in a way, that you kind of always know it's him, and yet he's enjoying himself. He's got wonderful comic timing. He's sort of turning his nose up at her awful rundown flat and sniffing at old bits of cheese. And, you know, it's beautifully done, and there's a chemistry between them. So I actually think they pull it off in this production.
He does have a rather strange habit of actually swallowing words entirely. Just he'll stop a sentence mid-word and continue. It is very mannered. But he did take over from Gambon in the West End when the play transferred. So it's not the first time he's done it. This again, like we were saying about Miss Saigon, it's a show we've seen before. So how does this compare, Matt?
Well, the funny thing is, whereas I can't remember a single thing about Fathers and Sons in 1987, I remember the original production of this as if it were yesterday. And I remember the opening night at the Cottesloe, and I remember being given the text and looking at the cover of the text, which I still have at home, and this beautiful picture of Leah Williams on the cover. And I thought that was very interesting because all of the hype had been about Gambon, Michael Gambon. And of course, the part of Kira, the Leah Williams, now Carey Mulligan part, is the larger part. She's in every single second of the play, pretty much. And I thought that first production was really stunning. I loved Gambon and Williams as a duo. I thought they were just about as good as it gets. And it had a kind of indefinable sexual magnetism to it, which was just very raw. I mean, there was a scene where, you know, Gambon at some point comes out, presumably the bedroom, and his shirt is undone and his hair is tousled, and you just think, wow, there's an animalistic passion here. That is not what Bill Nighy projects. It's just not his thing. So this has a very different flavor to it. That said, I think it's a very strong play, one of Hare's best plays, and it can take lots of different approaches. And to me, Carey Mulligan was a little too indrawn. There was an expansiveness to Leah Williams emotionally. I also think Carey Mulligan's just a tiny little bit too young. There was something about Leah Williams that she'd seen more, she knew more. But look, if you didn't see that original production, you could do a lot worse.
I think that there's a really interesting thing that nobody is really mentioning, which is that in fact, Carey Mulligan is only 2 years younger than Leah Williams was when she created the role. The difference here is that there is a 35-year age gap between Carey Mulligan and Bill Nighy. And actually, I think that if the play were conceived with that amount of an age gap, there has to be an age gap, but if it was that wide, there would be lines to support it. And you lose something both in terms of the magnetism between the two. Of course, people have relationships across generations. But that gap is problematic here. I think Mulligan is really good, actually. I think her containment is absolutely about trying to find an opposition to Bill Nighy, who is pacing about the place. The script that she has a line where she tells him off for doing that, so it's not an indulgence on Nighy's part. And I think that Nighy is rather tremendous in this. And for the first half of the play, I thought, I've completely misjudged this. In my mind, it was a less good play than it turned out to be. And at the interval, I went, you know what? This is one of the really good David Hare plays. This really is terrific. And then in the second half, David Hare emerges from behind the characters, and I go, oh, that's why I remember it not being such a great play, because you do get the fact that the argument is completely stacked. The very end of the play has a terrible hoary old device of concealed information suddenly being brought out in order to sort of nail up the end of the play. But even before that, you know, why does she have to be living, because she's a teacher and because she's left wing, why does she have to be a hair shirt left wing, oh, pardon the pun, left wing teacher living in, you know, the grottiest of flats? Why does she have to be struggling so hard? And he's such a Thatcherite. With the distance between them that far, it feels manipulative, and I felt it lessened the impact of the play.
Well, sorry.
The irony of you mentioned the grot is a flat, it's in the most expensive of sets. I mean, this is a huge, huge set. You see not just their flat, but you also see the entire rest of the council estate that the flat's located on.
I think that's fair enough because it gives you the perspective. I do think that actually I think Stephen Daldry has done a very, very impressive production. I'm not sure that in terms of production you're going to see a better version of this play. I just happen to think there's slightly less than meets the eye and ear here.
I think the thing though about the age difference, which is absolutely right to point out, is that with the original there was this kind of physical quality that this one sort of doesn't have, for age reasons, for affect reasons, and so it becomes much more ideologically pitched as opposed to sort of animalistically pitched. Yeah. And that's a loss. On the other hand, you know, I do think it is a fine play, and I think it'll do well when it goes to Broadway in the spring.
I slightly disagree with that. I kind of think Bill Nighy has a sort of irritating sexual charisma that I can buy that she would be attracted to him for all the political gap. And I agree that the age occurs to you as you're watching it, but I think it's just about credible. And I think the set sets a wider scene so that you see not just her flat, you see that she's in a whole social world. And I actually think in that West End, quite big West End theatre, if it was just a grungy flat, you would struggle with the yes. play feeling rather petty and dreary.
So who's sexier, Kate, Bill Nighy or Michael Gambon?
Well, I would say Bill Nighy, but that's just personal taste, you see.
I feel like I'm banging on about the same thing, but I can completely see, you know, people go wild for Bill Nighy, large swathes of the female population, for all I know, male population, that find him immensely attractive. And that's not at issue for me. What's at issue is the fact that I can completely see that there would be a pull towards someone that she used to be attracted to when she was a young, inexperienced woman. But you kind of go, the play is predicated on the fact that they're going to have a continuing relationship at this point in their lives. And I just looked at it after a while and went, no, this isn't going to work.
I don't think they are.
I don't think they are, but I think that's what Nye's character wants.
Yes.
And therefore it has to be logical.
Yeah.
Or does he want another daughter? Does he want a surrogate daughter, which this production suggests rather more than the first one, where you thought he really needed a lover? So.
I think there's a tiny question at the end. I asked other people about whether they thought that. There's a tiny question because there's a son in it as well. He's played by the very, very good young actor, Matthew Beard, who's rather charmingly gawky. And I think it's a tiny question mark about whether she might actually get together with the son.
Well, he's a lot nearer in age to her.
He's nearer in age.
Yeah. Can't have the father go for the son. Yeah. There we go. Skylight the sequel.
Finally, in this section, it's almost exactly 60 years since Arthurman as the Crucible received its British premiere at the Bristol Vic in November 1954, after opening on Broadway the year before, and now it's back at London's Old Vic. The play has long become one of those dogged staples of the repertoire and a school set text that's difficult to see through fresh eyes. Matt, do you think this one does see it through fresh eyes?
Yeah, I have to say, by the way, I should preface this by saying I saw a preview of it because I was going away. So I'm sure whatever it has now become is quite different to what I saw. But what is clearly true about what I saw, and I'm sure it's been amplified since then, is that Yael Farber, the South African director of it, doesn't see the play as a civics lesson or homework or as something that is good for you. She sees it as something very visceral, physical, emotional. When I saw it at what was only, I think, the fifth performance, it was a lot of atmosphere being ladled on very, very heavily, and it was much longer than it now is. It was running close to 4 hours, and clearly that has been stripped back. But what was very interesting was the attempt to see the play from the inside out, not to present John Proctor as kind of this doomed figure of, you know, rhetorical nobility, but as somebody who is flawed in his own right, and to really give a sense of the climate of Salem in 1692, the hysteria then, the way it resonates with hysteria now, and the way in which, you know, as is true of all great plays, the more localized they are, the more they speak to the generations.
It certainly runs over 3.5 though, still. Did you consider it, because it usually runs about 3 hours 10,
originally.
Did you feel it was too long?
I thought it was, I didn't really feel it was too long. I thought they were still really ladling on the atmosphere. I mean, the thing that I balked at, really, was lots of really sound score, a bit filmic, sort of punctuating the scenes that were meant to be getting nasty and ominous and tense. And I think in a way, I felt it didn't trust the play. I think the play is incredibly strong. And it is incredibly strong in this production, but I felt as if the directing in a way was feeling the need to hype that. And it's good, and I think Anna Madley is wonderful as John Proctor's wife. She's very kind of contained, and I've seen her played more bitter, which gives him a bit of a reason to reject her. But I found her very moving. My main cavil was really with Richard Armitage, who, for me, was slightly doing the voice beautiful, and I think rather overemphasizing the lyricism of his pseudo period language, which is rather beautiful, but I feel as if he was making it arty, whereas in fact I think what you should be doing is playing it earthy and playing it for real, and I felt he was doing sort of actory emoting.
I didn't like this production as much as the Dominic Cook production that Ian Glen was superlative in, that began at the RSC and then came to Shaftesbury Avenue. To me, that's the best Crucible I've seen. But this isn't, you know, I applaud the attempt of this production, yet again, like the recent Young Vic View from the Bridge, to just sort of look at Arthur Miller in a different way, not naturalistically, not as, again, a kind of medicinal playwright, but as somebody who really has a sense of moral engagement and sheer sort of passion.
And interestingly, like A View from a Bridge, it's also staged in the round,
yes.
which gives it a much more...
It was very shouty when I saw it. I hope that's changed. It was very shouty, particularly in the second act.
I think In the Round makes it, you know, it makes it like a crucible in a way. You know, you're encircling it, and that is very intense. And he's a very strong and increasingly gripping and moving production. And actually, the costumes are rather interesting because they're not quite the classic puritanical outfits you think of. They're a bit more like fundamentalist Muslim. I mean, they're period, but the women are wearing dark headscarves. So it could be, you know, you're not quite sure where you are. I'm not suggesting it's meant to be Muslim.
Well, I did an interview with the director, and that's intended.
Yeah.
That is very much intended, so that you're constantly saying, where is this taking place?
Yeah, and I think that's good. And I somehow struggled with the transitions between naturalism and choreography. So there were moments that are suddenly quite stylized, and I'm usually up for that. But I found them rather intrusive in this production.
On that note, thanks, Dominic, Kate, Matt, and David.